My name is Stevie B, and I'm a grateful believer and a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. And a proud member of the West Side Men's Group.
Nice.
It's good to be here with you guys tonight. Whew. I got to tell you that hearing about Don Ho, took a little wind out of my sails for a second there. And then I was remembering that this is just a temporary assignment. The best we're going to get is 100 years, 110 years, most of us 80 years. And while Don was here, he had ups and he had downs, and this is not a eulogy to Don, but you know, one thing about him you want to say is that he was serious about his recovery. He was serious about his recovery. And there's a lot of us in here that knew him. We had run-ins with him. Whoo! Because, yeah, he was serious about his recovery. And I got to tell you something, I'm serious about my recovery. Serious about my recovery. There's very few people you're going to meet, they're going to say to you, do you know Stevie B? They're not going to be like, if they know me, they're not going to be on the fence. You either love me or hate me. Serious about my recovery, serious about my relationship with God, serious about my relationship with my family. Not willing to concede on any of those. Not willing to miss my meeting schedule, not willing to change anything that's going perfectly in my life right now. Not willing to do any of it. God's been so very good to me over these last 9 years and in a couple weeks that I don't want to change one thing. The men that came before me at this very podium, one of them which is here tonight, I watched growing up in this 12-step house since I was 24 years old. Coming into meetings like this, watching men like Paul stand up here and say, if you're here for the first time, welcome. You're off the hook. And when I heard that the first time that I was off the hook, I had been on the hook for so long that when someone finally said I was off the hook, I took a breath of relief. I was like, wow, I'm off the hook. And then I heard the next line, he said that you don't have to use even if you want to. You're off the hook. I know that's the same line that Richard Spike heard 20 years ago. Same line that I heard 15 years ago. You're off the hook. Same line the church heard. You're off the hook. And you know what? I believe today that I'm off the hook. But I will also tell you guys, this is the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And when we do the steps over the next 10 weeks, we're going to be doing the steps. So yes, you're going to get some good stories in there, and there's going to be some antidotes and some fun. But tonight, we're going to get down to business. Because this is Don Ho's last day whenever he passed. And if this is your last day, on December 15th, 2010. Is that today's date, the 15th? 14th. December 14th, 2010. If this is your last day, what are they going to say about you? Are they going to say he was full of potential? He almost got it? Man, she was almost sober. She almost got the message. She almost stayed clean. That's not what they're going to say about me today. They say, I lived my sobriety like I lived my using. Out to the wall. I didn't leave anything on the table. I don't miss any meetings. I don't miss any events. I don't miss any free food. I show up at all anniversary parties if I'm not working because I want the whole kit and caboodle. Because when I came in, I didn't come to believe. I came in just to be off the hook. Now, if you would have told me that some years later, that the farthest thing from my mind would be taking a drink or drug, I would have thought, you're crazy. All I want to do is just be off the hook for tonight. I just want to take a breath. I just want to take a break. I want to figure out where I'm going to get some more. I don't want to figure out how I'm going to have another drink. I just want to be off the hook for one night. And I remember this as clear as day. I looked over at my wife and I had been using in the house and she didn't know it. It's so hot in here. Is it hot in here? You know, one thing about the 12-step house, last time I did the steps, it was August. It was the same exact temperature as it is this room and now. And now it's 20 degrees outside. It's the same exact temperature. And so this is like a separate entity. It's like its own island, the 12-step house. It's always 100 degrees in here, no matter what it is. It doesn't matter August or December. It's exactly the same. I looked over at my wife, and I had been using it in the house during the night. Someone said to me last week, and I do appreciate this, and I'm not throwing anything disparaging out. Someone said to me that I spoke too much about drugs, that it sounded like a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. But I want to tell you something, and I appreciate the feedback, but I want to tell you something. I'm a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. I believe in every single principle that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in the entire 164 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I let that lead my life. I also believe in all the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. But for me to pretend that the only thing that I did was drinking is just not true. I also believe in singleness of purpose. But during the next 11 weeks, there's going to be stuff that's going to leak out that's going to sound like other than alcohol type of behavior. There's no way else to get around it. I can't be talking about drinking and drinking and drinking and shooting drinking and all. It just doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense. It sounds foolishness. And I'm not here to sound foolish. I'm going to tell you exactly how it was, what it was like, and how it is now. I'm sorry if that offends some people, but that's just the way it is. So I'm using super alcohol in my house, and I can't get to sleep, and I haven't eaten for 3 weeks, and I'm like whittled down to the bone, and my cheekbones are sticking out of the top of your face, and my eyes are sunk back in my head. And there's a, well, let me just tell you a little antidote. It has nothing to do with this step. Is that don't ever trust anybody on how you look to give you feedback. Because when that was happening to me, my eyes were sunk in the back of my head, my face was whittled down, I had cheekbones sticking out like antennas. People are like, man, you look great. They thought I looked great because I lost 100 pounds. I didn't look great, and I didn't feel great, and I was dying from the inside, and I was decaying from the inside, and I couldn't eat. I had to make myself eat. It was awful. I looked over at my beautiful wife, and I thought to myself, if I ever could sleep next to her for the whole night and wake up with her in the same bed, I will have achieved everything that I ever wanted out of life. Because the moment that beautiful woman would lay her head down on the pillow, it was on. And I would lay there and my hands would be shaking, my body would be shaking, and I'd be saying, come on, let's get to sleep, let's get to sleep, let's get to sleep. And my body said, oh no, it's party time. We're going to get it on. And I didn't want to. I didn't want to stay up all night, and I didn't want to do the things that I did in the very house that we had bought together, that we got married together, that my parents had helped me with, my grandfather helped me. I didn't want to do that, but I was a slave to what I was doing. I was not off the hook. I was totally on the hook. The disease of alcohol has had me hook me in the mouth, line and sinker, and it would lead me where I wanted to go. Someone in our home group said I was its beat. I was, you know, I can't say that, but I'm just saying it led me with a hook in my mouth. It said, you'll wake up at this time, you'll go to bed at this time, you'll eat at this time, you'll go to work at this time, and I was a slave to alcohol. So the only thing I wanted that night when I looked over my wife is if I could just lay my head down on the pillow and wake up in the morning next to her at the same time, man, I would have had it all. And let me tell you something, brothers, is I would have settled for that. I would have settled for just that. If you would have said to me, well, what do you want, Steve, in your wildest dreams? 9 years from now, you'll be inside the 12-step house. There'll be 200 people here. You'll have one of your mentors sitting there, one of your best friends sitting there, and your parents sitting there. You'll be sober almost 9 years. Your wife will be dancing at a church in the nearby area, praying for you that you're going to do a great job. I would have said, no, man, I don't want any of that. I just want to wake up next to her like 8 hours from now and not have destroyed my life from the inside out. I'll take that. God had a different plan. And I didn't even believe in him at the time. That's what I want to tell you about. The second step, the principle behind it is hope. Hope is the principle behind the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The principle behind that step is hope. And I want to tell you that I believe the step is hope. But I want to tell you behind that hope is a thing called evidence, is a thing called proof. Because alcoholics only do so well with hope. We're that's like a short little sprint for us, hope. We're okay with the idea of hope, but you better back it up with some facts. You see, you tell 250 alcoholics that there's food at a party and then there's not, you better hope, you better get some. You see, we hope it's going to be there, but if it's not, you better back it up with some fact. So the principle behind the second step is hope, but what God knew that I needed, and I see a lot of you also needed, he knew I needed some facts. I needed some evidence. I needed to have some evidence that it was real. See, coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity could only keep me coming back so long. I needed to have some facts, some evidence. And that's what the second step for me is all about. I know other people that I see some, you know, people in here that I have a lot of respect for their sobriety. I know they came in and then they came to believe and life has just been unbelievable for them. That's not my case. When I came in when I was 25 years old, life got really, really good, really, really fast. And I got back a lot of stuff or even got stuff for the first time. And that wasn't enough for me. That wasn't enough for me. Because if the only thing that you come into Alcoholics Anonymous for is to get stuff back or get stuff from the first time, mark my words, pay attention to this one statement, it won't be enough and you will go out again. If the only thing you're coming in here for is to get back your stuff, let me tell you something, you will get back your stuff. You'll get back other stuff and that will not be enough. Alcoholics have an amazing forgetter. We could be trying for a job. We could be trying for a job for months at a time. We get that job. The boss calls us and says, you get this job. Earl, come on in. I'm going to give you this job. You feel good? How much are you willing to pay me? They're like, I'm going to start you off at $12 an hour. I would love to start off at $12 an hour. That's fantastic. $12 an hour. Alcohol will be on the job for a couple weeks, $12 an hour. We'll start thinking, Matt, I'm not getting paid enough, am I? And I'm worth a lot more than $12 an hour. Start thinking to myself, what am I even doing here at $12 an hour? Man, a guy like me for $12 an hour. A couple days later, you'd be talking about the boss. Now, you understand, a couple months before, you were asking the job, you get the job, and then a couple weeks later, you're walking in, the boss is walking in, good morning, and you're like, good morning, but underneath your breath, it's like $12 an hour. If you have alcoholism, if you have this disease that centers in your mind, coming back into the program or coming into the program for the first time or the second time or fifth time, and you come back for your stuff, it won't be enough. Because once you get the girl or the guy, the job, the car, you sit in a chair for a few 24 hours, it will not be enough. And you'll start saying stuff while you're sitting there. Is this all there is? Year and a half ago, you're smoking stuff out of tire tracks on State Road 84. A year and a half later, you got new clothes on. You pulled in here in your new car. You got or any car. You're sitting there with some friends. And you're like, is this all there is? Did I get sober for this? We have magnificent, magnifying minds. And we could become, Todd, you know what I'm talking about. We could become ungrateful. We can become ungrateful. We could become forgetful. We have holes in our psyche. We forget who we are and we think we're more than we are. And some of that works for our benefit. That's why we rise so fast in companies, but that's why we fall so fast in companies too. That's why we go to the top of the leaderboard and then we're unemployed. People are like, wasn't that Steve? Wasn't he the head of the... Yeah, but he got too big. That's why a lot of alcoholics and people in the program, they need to work for themselves. They're always self-employed. Hello, right here, I'm self-employed. And if I wasn't self-employed, I would have been fired 1,000 times ago. Even the self-employed, I'm not even that good of an employee, I want to tell you. Where was I? There needs to be something behind that step. You're going to have to stay for a reason. The reason that they put step two and came to believe that a power greater than themselves, they know you need something entryway. And like Paul always says, it's like a shill game. They pretend that you're coming in here to get sober, and then all of a sudden they unleash God on you. That's next week. For last week, we were talking about old things, and me peeking out of the windows, and me building a house underneath my stairs, and everyone was laughing. Ooh. You're so funny. But behind that, there's a step that's coming up that you're going to have to make a decision. You're going to have to make a decision because only that fun and all that fun and games has got to stop. There's going to be a place where the big book says the rubber has to meet the road. You're going to have to see what you really are here for. If you're here to get back to stuff, you will get back to stuff. I got back to stuff. 6.5 years into my sobriety, it wasn't enough. 6 years into my sobriety, I started saying, is this all there is? Did I get sober for this? 6.5 years earlier, I was living on the streets of Minneapolis, going in and out of places that I only saw in movies. The only white guy in this whole neighborhood, thinking I was New Jack City. Six and a half years later, I'm like, this is what I sobered up for like this. One of the reasons that we're allowed to tell our story from podiums like this in different places is so that we remember who we were. Because we're going to get to a place in our life when everything's so fantastic around us, we're going to even forget that that's who we were. We're going to think it's another person's story. It's not. Also in my life, I think that the closer that I get with God, the farther I am away from where I used to be. And that's true. But that same person that I came in with, that same alcoholic that I came with, is still inside me. How I know that is because when I gave my life to God in the step three, and he gave me evidence, which I needed, and he cleaned up my vocabulary, which was awful. My vocabulary was always awful. My parents are here, and they'll tell you, it was, you know, right underneath the surface of me smiling, it was always an F-bomb, right underneath there. It was always bubbling. And kind of the neighborhood I'm from is, you know, F-bombs is kind of like the way we talk. You know, I see some guys with the same look, yeah, they're like, who? So when I made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God, that was taken from me. Totally gone. My vocabulary changed. I needed evidence. That was some of the evidence that I got. But when I hit myself with a hammer or when I do something really, really hurtful or something like that, that old guy comes out, boom, right there. Man, I had maybe sometimes I hadn't cursed in like 6 months. All of a sudden, poof, right there, like it was always hanging out there. Where did that come from? It's always there. So anytime that I think I might be recovered from alcoholism, I'm wrong. I know people in here say that they're recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I have no problem with that. But I'm not recovered from alcoholism. I have it living inside me just waiting for me to use words like, I'm recovered. I'll be sober for the rest of my life. I can hang out here. My disease waits for me to use statements like that. It's just waiting in the background. Oh, tell me you're recovered. Tell me you used to be an alcoholic. Go ahead, Steve. Tell him. You used to have a problem, but you're recovered now. And I just wait till when I hear those type of words inside my head, I say, oh, no. Because when I was 6 years sober, I started to think I was recovered. And I told my parents, my beautiful parents, they'd never seen me ever relapse. And I told them, I said, I think I'm going to start drinking again. My parents said, I don't think it's a good idea. God's honest truth, there's no exaggeration. They said, I don't think it's a good idea. But I didn't have alcoholism in my story. What I had was drug addiction. So when I said I was going to start drinking, I wasn't talking about going back to drink drugs. I was talking about just drinking, social drinking. Fine wine drinking, as a matter of fact. What's wrong with you people? I could be a fine wine drinker. I could drink a Beaujolais or something like that. You know, if I had a Beaujolais walk right by me, I wouldn't even know what a Beaujolais is. But somehow, Pat, during my 6 years, I was thinking I was a Beaujolais drinker. Anyway, I took that drink, and you guys were here last week. You heard the rest of the story. I took that drink, and that drink turns me, and I turned into a big book alcoholic. You see, it turns out that I'm not just a drug addict. I am an alcoholic. It turns out that I love anything that affects me from the neck up, anything that could keep me from feeling anything, anything. I tried some stuff when I was out there those 2 years that I didn't even know they had names for, mixing it up in bathtubs in the backyards and house, Home Depot chemicals, and the guy's like, try this. Oh, okay. Turns out that I will use anything. Anything. I saw myself when I was on my honeymoon, they started to pour out this wine in a decanter and they weren't drinking it. And I looked over at my wife and I was 5 years sober and I said to my wife, I said, what are they doing? We were on our honeymoon in New Orleans. I said, I wonder what they're doing. They're just pouring the wine and they're just letting it sit there. And I said to the waiter, we were in Emeril Lagasse's restaurant. I said, what are they doing with that wine? She says, they're letting it breathe. I said, what? She said, they're letting it breathe. It's in a decanter. It breathes on the table, and then they drink it. And I thought to myself, that's the way I could drink. I could let the wine breathe. I could go back, you know, and sip it, and I could be a fine wine type of drinker. And then when I relapsed, and when I went to drink the fine wine, I realized I didn't like fine wine. I like Thunderbird 2020 is what I like. I like Mad Dog 2020. I like all that stuff, you know. I like Manischewitz. You know, anything that's sweet and then destroy your inside from the inside out. I like stuff that was, you know, like potatoes 8 minutes ago. I like vodka that was just made yesterday. I don't want any fine stuff or nothing. I want stuff that was just turned yesterday. They pressed that yesterday. When was that done? Yesterday. That's what I want. Next thing you know, I'm powerless, completely powerless. I can't stop drinking. I'm lying about drinking. I have bottles, I have airplane bottles hidden in my pants. Little airplane, my wife and I, we go on a vacation. She says, maybe we just need to get away. So we go to a health resort on the West Coast, Sanibel Island. We go to a health resort. We're working out. And I hadn't escalated to the harder stuff, but I was totally addicted to alcohol. I started to pack my workout pants with the little airline bottles. We were having a beautiful dinner at overlooking the water there. In sobriety, I would have been totally grateful for it. Instead, all I could think about is how was I going to get the drink that was in my pants into my mouth. My wife thought that I wasn't drinking. She had thought I just drank once. I'm thinking the whole time, well, we're in this beautiful suite. Because if you stay sober 6.5 years, unless you're gambling or something, you're going to accumulate some money. So I had some money. We're staying in this beautiful suite. I had only been drinking for about 3-4 weeks. Overlooking the water, my wife, and we're eating dinner. Private dinner on the balcony. My wife's like, isn't this wonderful? We just needed to get away. And all I can hear is, drink. How am I going to get the drink? Where am I going to get the drink? How am I going to get the drink? She's talking all sudden. All I hear out of her mouth is, you're going to drink? When you're going to drink? How are we going to get the drink? I lean back in my chair. All the bottles fall out of my pants. My wife said, where'd that come from? I said, I don't know. Some alcoholic probably was here in the room before we got here. The whole trip was ruined. And I said to my wife, if I ever needed to come back into the program, I would. I would just come right back. See, I thought that powerlessness had to do with you being willing to come back. I found out that powerlessness means exactly that. I was totally powerless when I wanted to come back. I crawled in here on my belly. Powerlessness doesn't mean you just go out and you come back when you want. Go out and try some controlled drinking, come back when you want. That has nothing to do with powerlessness. Powerlessness means just this, you have no power. Took the drink took me, I was totally addicted. All I cared about where I was going to get my next drink. My parents knew after speaking to me 9/11 that I was addicted to different things in the house. And then they came down and they kicked open the door and they saw me there in the house. And they saw the house destroyed. And they knew I had stepped it into a different level of not just drinking on weekends. And I said to my parents, listen, if I can't stop while Sandy's away, she was in Columbia, if I can't stop, then we'll do something. And my parents, broken, only knowing their son sober, only knowing their son for the last 6.5 years sober, broken, seeing me completely addicted, my face all gaunt, and me not being able to stop using, took me to meetings after meetings after meeting my dad. Because now my dad was 9 years sober. So it's taking me to meetings, it's taking meetings, and I keep getting drunk. And I'm drinking all night long, I'm drinking all night. My parents would come in the morning and say, we took the car, you have no money. How is it that you're getting drunk all night long? You know how we do things. You know, Josh, we had delivery service. You know, I had people coming over, delivering service, hiding underneath the bushes in my, you know how it works. Giving them the special look, you know. Dying from the inside out, can't stop. You guys heard the story last week. My wife calls me from the airport. My parents are there. It's her birthday. She lands in Columbia. She's like, I'm here, sweetheart. Come and pick me up. I can't stop using. I said, I'm right outside the airport, honey, and I can't stop using. I'm in the house in Hollywood. She's in Miami. She's waiting there. My parents are like, where aren't you going to go pick her up? I'm like, I can't stop using. So she thinks I'm coming at any second. She's waiting for me. She doesn't understand how bad it's gotten. And I want to be there. I want to be there more than anything in the world. Let me tell you something. My desire was not to be standing in the house completely a slave to alcohol. My desire was to put that stuff down and go pick her up. I'm not playing. This is not part of the play game of the story. I couldn't stop. My beautiful wife's standing there. She calls up my father and she's like, where is he? My dad's broken inside because he knows his son is completely addicted. My dad, who I would go to meetings with and do my program with, now his son is a complete relapse. He goes and picks her up. I do what I do. I'm standing there when she comes back with some balloons. And 4 hours later with some balloons, like that was going to help. I'm like, oh, the balloons took a long time to blow up. Me and my excuses, me and my intentions. The whole world was judging me on my actions, and I'm judging myself on my intentions. I really wanted to be there. My intentions were to be there for her. My actions, it showed that I couldn't be there. I was powerless. So when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't come like, whoo, there's nothing else going on. I came to because I was being dragged through the mud, through the mire of powerlessness. I didn't come here because there was no other place to go. I came here because I had no other place to go. So the reason I take my program so seriously is because my addiction and my relapse was so serious. The reason I don't take any shortcuts is because I didn't take any shortcuts when I was out there. There wasn't a day that went by that I didn't try to figure out a way and means to get more. A way and means to get yours from you. A way and means to figure out how to get to just keep this whole thing going. I remember, and the only reason I mention this is because my parents are here. This is their first time here. They just came down from New York. And I remember I said to my mother and father, I said to them, and this is really the truth, I said to them, I could leave the house right now and I could run across the tracks and go get high and you couldn't stop me. We were in my house in Hollywood and I was saying to my parents, you can't stop me. If I want to get high, I'm going to get high. I'll run out the front door and I'll run across the tracks and I'll get high. And my mother looked over and she goes, and then what? I'm like, what do you mean, and then what? And then I'll be high. You see, to an alcoholic, that we don't have an and what. We don't play out the tape. I'm thinking just run as fast as I can across the tracks. Sell my 2 shoes that I get over there. I'm broke. I'm like, I got shoes. And my mother's just crying, and she goes, and then what? And then what? You know what? If you're here tonight and you've been let off the hook, let's let the no more and then what's. We were already here. If you're here, you already came to believe. If you made a decision tonight, Tuesday, December 14th, you already came to believe. At least that there's something better for us. If you're already here, we don't have to get here. There's a whole million people outside of Fort Lauderdale. They're not even here yet. They haven't even started on the powerlessness journey. Half of them are going to die before they get into the 12-step house. The other half, when they get in here, they're going to take shortcuts and they're only going to stay a little bit of time. They're going to 13-step. They're going to think it's a dating service and half of those people are going to die. And then in 5 years from now, they're going to say, what happened to Sally? What happened to Joe? Oh, you know, they stopped coming. You know how many people Paul Lee has buried, and this is not to just keep, but I've been to like 10 of the funerals that he's been at. How many times he spoke from the podium at people's funerals? I can't even tell you. Because as the road continues to get, it gets narrower. You can't start dating in halfway. You know, this is a serious deal. So they put me in Fort Lauderdale Hospital, and I get inside the Fort Lauderdale Hospital, but I know that I still got alcohol frozen in like a can in my freezer. And the whole time I'm in there, and I don't know if this ever happened to you, but I'm in there, and I'm like, I want to be sober, but I know I have a can of like super alcohol hidden behind the meat in my freezer. Now, but I'm in there, and I'm really being serious about being sober, but just in case, I don't tell anybody about my stash. Now, how does that work? I'm actually lying to myself. I'm actually fiending myself. I'm actually have two things going on. One is I'm raising my hand at 12-step meetings. The other is just in case I have a freezer full of stuff at home. Just in case I have an entire storage unit full of stuff. And of course, because the back door is not closed, because I haven't let out all the stops, I use again. And this time it's worse. And this time my wife serves me with a restraining order inside of a treatment center. And she says, don't come back. And this time she calls on my parents and they go and they get divorce papers drawn up for me. My parents, my wife, draw up divorce papers and have me sign over everything to her. I'm their son. Can you imagine that place that they needed to be in to have them go and have everything signed away from their son? Can you imagine that place? That's not what I was shooting for. When in high school, they said, most likely to run across the tracks and get high one more time. Here's my shoes. That's not what I was shooting for, but that's what I become. So when I came here and I heard the person that was speaking from the podium on a Tuesday night say, I'm Paul Lee and I'm an alcoholic and you're off the hook. Man, let me tell you something. I needed to be off the hook. And when I first saw Don back, Don's my friend, we sobered up together. When I first saw him back at Victory and I looked over at him and now he's like 10 years and I'm like 10 minutes and we sobered up together and he's picking up a 10-year medallion and I'm picking up a 10-minute medallion. And he's now married and has a good, wonderful life, and I can't stay sober. And I don't know if this ever happened to you guys, but life will go on. People will go and have families and get jobs and look good. And you'll be, you know, coming out of IRT for the 75th time. Woo! And they give you a cake. Now, I'm not putting down IRT. If you're in that program, that's fantastic. I'm not putting down where you're at. But make it count now. I mean, when I got out of BARC that last time after being there for nine months, I took that thing seriously. People are like, can you pee in my cup? You know, all that nonsense. No, I can't pee in your cup. I take this stuff seriously. You know why I take it seriously? Jimmy will tell you, because I almost died out there. So when they said there's a speaker at the 12-step house and he's got a great message, and he's talking about the solution and not the problem, I show up. No sporting event, no nothing with my wife is more important than me and getting my sobriety first. Because without that, let me tell you something, guys, I don't have anything. I have nothing. We have a guy in our home group that likes to continue to say, I forget what he said, but it's something about being important, that his sobriety is the most important thing in his life. He's got 25 years sober. Nothing is more important than being sober. Because without that, we have nothing. So I'm at the detox. And I relapsed again, broken inside. And a halfway house manager comes up to me, Jeff Weinstein, and he says to me, Jeff W., sorry, take that, scratch that. And he says to me, would you like to come to our halfway house? Would you like to come to Liberty House? Now, I owned a house in Hollywood with my wife, okay? And I wasn't going to any halfway house. But my wife had served me with a restraining order, and I couldn't get into the house. Plus, I had no money. Okay, so, and I had no car. And I had no clothes. I had no food. I didn't have a lot of resources at the time. So when he came to me and he's like, would you like to come move in the halfway house? I'm like, I'm not coming to move a halfway house. I'm going to Hollywood where I have my full house. You know, I still had my strut. I had like 3 days. I was in the psycho ward on the third floor. It's the fourth floor of the hospital. I just eaten and I had just shaved. I'm like, okay, I got a full house. That's what's up. And he's like, he showed me the paper, the restraining order, and the divorce papers. And he says, you know, your wife has agreed to pay for the house if you go to the halfway house. And I said, okay, that seems like a good place to go, the halfway house. Yeah. I became sweetly reasonable. I signed up for that deal real fast. I walk up to the halfway house. I get dropped off by Jeff W. And standing there in the courtyard is a guy that I used to sponsor who's now the halfway house manager. And he could see that I hadn't had a run of luck for a while. Yeah, I wasn't driving in there in my Corvette, you know what I'm saying? I was like dropped off there with the plastic bag from the Fort Lauderdale hospital. My flip-flops. What's up, Richie? I go, what's up, Richie? Trying to act all cool. You know, thinking maybe he thought I was going to speak there. You know, maybe he thought I was there to spread the message. Had a little temporary bad luck. He looks over at me and he says, would you like a sandwich? Now, let me tell you something, brothers and sisters. I don't know if you've ever been in a place in your life where you used to sponsor guys, you used to go bring the message in, you used to be a guy that was sober, and then someone says to you, would you like a sandwich? There's nothing like it in the world. You want to talk about incomprehensible demoralization? You want to talk about going from this size to this size? You want to talk about being right-sized? I was no-sized. And I knew right there, it's not going to get much better than this. I needed to take that sandwich. He said, I have some sheets for your pillowcase. And all of a sudden I became, started listening. And I started on my journey of coming to believe. And about 30 days into that journey of coming to believe, I started to get the halfway house shuffle. Now remember, I had 6 years of sobriety. I had grown up on Paul E. tapes. I had grown up following Spike around town. I had grown up seeing all you guys, and I had the lingo down. So 30 days into the program, I'm like talking to guys inside the halfway house, my roommate Eddie. I'm talking to different guys, and I'm like trying to school them on the big book. I'm trying to bring him on in. And would you guys, I'm trying to help hold a step meeting, but now I got like 32 days. I'm holding a step meeting at the halfway house, trying to spread some of the message that I've been given. And I wake up in the morning, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I look at my watch. And I decide that this is going to be the day that I'm going to go out and I'm going to try some more research, and no one's going to find out about it. During that time of being living in a halfway house, there was this tough guy, Jewish sponsor that I had back in the day when I lived in Minneapolis. His name was Jerry Bear. Jerry Bear was this little, like, tough Manhattan guy, and he was old school AA, and he didn't play around. And I called my parents, or called Sandy, and I said, you got to get me the number to Jerry Bear. And I called him. He lived in San Francisco. I said, Jerry, I need you to sponsor me, the only guy that knows me. You know, you have that one person in your life that you feel that that's the person that can send you the lifeline. You know, if I get that guy's a sponsor, if I get that girl's a sponsor, she could save my life. A lot of times, that person that's speaking from the podium, you feel if you can get that person, they're going to save your life. You get their number, you never call them back again, that type of stuff. Like, I got to have you as my sponsor. All right, call me tomorrow. They never called. But this time I was dying inside and I called him. I said, Jerry, I'll do whatever it takes. He said, Stevie, you're going to get on your knees and you're going to ask God to keep you sober. And at the end of the day, you're going to thank him. I said, Jerry, I'm not at that point yet. I'm still in a halfway house. I'm not really sure where my relationship is with God. I've been served with a restraining order. I don't know how I feel about that. Now, I also knew that Jerry was Jewish. I grew up in my father's Jewish, my mother's Catholic when I grew up. So I kind of knew both of the worlds. So I was new to the lingo. So I knew Jerry's Jewish. I knew he wasn't going to know anything about Catholic. So I said, Jerry, and plus, I'm a Catholic. We don't get down on our knees anywhere other than church. I figured I could slide that one in there. You know, use a little bit of grip. I could get past him on that. Because he was real Jewish. He teaches in yeshiva. And I figured he's not going to know the Catholic rules. Not like he's Joe Kavanaugh or something. I'm going to fool him. So I go, I can't pray outside of church on my knees. It's kind of like it's one of the rules. Jerry says to me, Stevie, do you want to die? And I said, no. He said, do you want to stay sober? I said, no. He said, then you're going to get down on your knees in the morning and you're going to get down on your knees at night. Because if I invited you over my house for Thanksgiving dinner and you sat down at the table and you grabbed the food like an animal and you didn't say please, and then you got up from the dinner table and you walked to the door and you walked out and you didn't say thank you, I would never invite you back again, would I? And I said, no, Jerry, you wouldn't. He said, so why do you think you need to be in God's world one day with the gift of sobriety and not say please in the morning and thank you at night, and I don't care what religion you are? And I understood. He said, Stevie, you better have a little respect for the disease of alcoholism and the disease of addiction, because the disease of addiction is not a flat-footed cop that walks around the streets of New York with a donut in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. The disease of addiction is like a Secret Service agent that walks in and out of parties unnoticed, that wears $1,000 suits, that knows how to use every weapon in the arsenal, and knows how to speak every language. And if you have any respect for your sobriety, you better have that much more respect for the disease of addiction. They convicted me right there on the spot. And I had been praying on my knees for those 30 days. I'd been praying on my knees. God, please keep me sober. And at the end of the day, I did what Jerry said, and I said, thank you for the gift of sobriety. Every day for 30 days. But at 30 days, I had the halfway house shuffle. Halfway house shuffle means I've been praying for 30 days. I've been showering for 30 days. I had been eating for 30 days, and I had been going to meetings for 30 days. I mean, I had a little bit of a step to me. I felt like maybe I had this thing, and I felt like that I had gotten a little power over the disease of addiction. I'd kind of forgot the story about it. And I thought, because I had been sober for 30 days, that if I just used for a certain amount of time during the day, that I would be able to stop on time before Eddie and Mason came home. They wouldn't know. I'd clean up, shower, and I would just be fine, and I would just have one day off for my sobriety. One day off. Now, I wasn't looking to get over on anybody. I was going to tell people when I got my year medallion, hold on. Back in the day, when I had 1 month, I used for a day. Next month, I'll pick up my year medallion. I had thought I had gained some power over the disease because I was 30 days sober. Got on my knees. I said, God, please keep me sober. And then I came up with a plan. I called up my wife. You got to hear this. You got to stay for this end of the story. It's unbelievable. I called up my wife and I said, sweetheart, I need to get $299 for the Samsung i300. The Samsung i300 was the iPhone of its day. It was the size of a big book. And it had a full keyboard on it. It was something else. It was really unbelievable. It came with a whole case and everything. And I said, I had to get that specific cell phone because I wanted to dial a lot of numbers because I wanted to be real connected in the program. And I called up my wife and I said, I need $299 and I need you to put it on the credit card that you'd give me. She gave me like this money card. You know, it was like a Target card or something that you can get money on. And she put me on hold and she said, hold on. And she called someone while I was holding on. And I thought she was calling to see if we had the money. She turns out that she was in the program of Al-Anon. Some of you have heard of it, I see. So she called up her sponsor and his sponsor says, give the bum his money. Let's find out exactly now at 30 days what he's all about before we wait a year to find out if he's full of it. And they put the money on my card. Now I know at 9:45, it's 9 a.m. in the morning, I know at 9:45 on Broward Boulevard on Federal Highway, I'm going to be in that Sprint store. At 10:07, I'm going to be out of that Sprint store. I'm going to have the cheapest cell phone they have, and I'm going to have $194 on my card still to go. I'm getting a $6 cell phone, and I'm going to be out of there. And I know that I'm about to go drinking for a couple hours, and then I'll stop drinking because I'll have power because I didn't use for 30 days. And I'll go to a motel, and I'll shower, and I'll shave, and by the time Eddie and Mason come back, they'll know nothing different. And I rush over to that place for the one more time after my parents were counting on me, my wife was counting on me, my sister was counting on me, and everyone was counting on me. I wanted to get high one more time. But I didn't want to let anybody down. I just wanted to have like a day off of sobriety. You see, I never thought anything through. So I get off my knees and I run to the Sprint store and I say to the guy behind the counter, I say, listen, man, I need to be out of here and I need to be out of here in 4 minutes. And I need to be connected because I knew I had to call my wife and tell her that I had the cell phone. She needed to see the new number, and I tell her I'm going to Victory. And I get to the guy behind the counter, and I say to the guy, I need that cell phone. I need it now, man. Let's go, let's go, let's go. And the guy behind the counter says to me, Stevie B, it's so good to see you back. I saw you yesterday at Victory picking up your under 30 days. Welcome back, man. We missed you. And the guy behind the counter had already come to believe. And at that moment, because God knew that hope was not enough for me, he knew that I needed evidence of things appearing real, he knew that I was going to need some facts, he showed me who he was in my life. Not just some hope, not just some fake thing, not something that other guys came up with. He was a real God. He was a God that was going to show up at the Sprint store, he was a God that was going to show up at meetings, and he was a guy that was going to show up in my life, and he was going to give me evidence, because that's what a guy like me needed. And the guy takes me outside and buys me a cup of coffee and starts my journey on coming to believe in a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Thanks for letting me share.